Welcome to Local Talk on KGY Community Radio, where we explore the people, stories, and events in Central Iowa. I am your host for today, Susan Franzen, together with my co-host, Ursula Rudenberg. Hello, Ursula.
Hello, Susan.
Today, we'll be hearing from Ruth Buckles of Youth and Shelter Services, followed by an interview with George Blitzos, founder and director of YSS. The program will conclude with Pat Schlarbaum telling us about an upcoming play.
This month, Kay Potok will be presenting a new series of interviews for our Community Service Appreciation segment of Local Talk. Appropriately enough, for the beginning of the new year, this month, Kay's focus is a nonprofit organization in Central Iowa that serves children and youth. Youth and Shelter Services, or YSS, is a whole network of services.
They focus on prevention, education, treatment, and residential services for children, youth, and their families. Kay says that before she began working on the segment, she hadn't realized how unique YSS is in our area and how much it owes to the vision of one person, George Blitzos.
This month we'll be hearing these separate interviews with people working in three different areas of YSS. Today's interview is with Ruth Buckles, who is giving an overview of the different services provided by YSS, and Ruth is also the chief coordinator of a relatively new program at YSS known as AMP, or Achieving Maximum Potential, which is youth-driven, a statewide group that aims to unleash the full potential of foster and adoptive children. AMP is Ruth's particular passion and is the main focus of this first interview. Later this month, we'll feature an interview with one of Ruth's adoptive children, a young woman who's been greatly helped by AMP and whom Ruth briefly mentions in this interview. Our third interview will be with Barb Biersma in YSS's mentoring program. But now let's go to today's interview and hear what Ruth has to say.
I'm Kay Potok, and I'm here with Ruth Buckles to talk about youth and shelter services. Welcome, Ruth. I'm so glad you could come.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
You've got a lot of experience with system youth. That's youth that have come through the court system or who are runaways or things like that. And you've adopted and fostered a lot of them. And that's a very interesting aspect of the things you've got to talk about. And we'll get to that later. But I'd really appreciate it if you'd start just by telling us about youth and shelter services in general and the different services they offer.
That's one of my favorite subjects. George Blitzos started Youth and Shelter Services back in the early 70s with a dream of building a place where youth would be safe from homelessness, from abuse, from neglect, and it has expanded since then. So right now, Youth and Shelter Services is, I believe, in 13 different counties as we branch out and reach out to anyone in need. There are programs from counseling and therapy, foster care, adoption, prevention education, which is going into our school systems and helping school-age children on up to college-age kids learn about their own bodies, their own safety, their own environment. We also have huge branches of our treatment programs, which in a lot of places in Iowa, that's what we're known for is treatment.
Treatment of what?
Of chemical dependency youth or youth that have struggled in their families maybe with self-abuse as well as domestic violence. So youth that have had some pretty rough experiences needing a chance to redefine what their world is and learn to live differently. And they can come into our treatment centers and get those experiences from the staff that are there to educate and nurture them and teach them new ways. So we have shelter services, we have treatment services, counseling therapy, foster care, adoption, prevention education, as well as many, many, many more community links that attach us to places like that are maybe helping pregnant or parenting, single families, married families, low-income families. We have a donation center where we help those that can't afford to go and buy the things that they need.
Things they might need for a new baby or for
anything,
children that haven't got a winter coat.
Or, coats, clothes. We have school drives. Ames is an incredible community of giving people. So in our program, our donations director can literally send out an email and say, this is what we know is a need. And people just come forward and say, I'm here to meet that need. I have that. I can give back. Overall, the agency is very large. I think there's 300 staff that are full-time and part-time within our agency, and we reach thousands of Central Iowans.
Now, if people want to find out about all the different services that YSS offers,
YSS.org.
How about the sort of a general phone number they could call?
I just call the business office because our ladies that are trained in the business office have been there for years. And they have grown YSS right beside George.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's kind of one of those things where we're a family within a family of a community.
So 233-3141.
That'll get you to our front desk.
Okay. I'll repeat that. So that's 515-233-3141 or Google or search on the web yss.org. Now, people in Ames, a lot of them probably know the Rosedale Shelter because it's mm-hmm. here downtown, well, in the old town. Beautiful old building there.
Yes.
What exactly happens at the Rosedale Shelter?
Youth that are homeless or they're in crisis or they're waiting for a treatment bed to open someplace in Iowa. They can't be home due to supervision needs or due to their involvement with the Department of Human Services or the juvenile court system. They need to be in an environment where there is staff 24/7, and so we have Rosedale Shelter, and it is a safe place for them to be. Food, clothing, shelters, education, as well as, you know, life skill lessons, intervention techniques. Staff there to help them rethink what they've experienced so that they can reframe that into a usable life lesson,
mm-hmm.
not just a victimization of, oh, poor pity me.
Right.
And Rosedale is phenomenal at that. They're very, very good at what they do.
Now, suppose someone is just at home, say, in Ames, and they're going through a rough patch with their parents, and they'd like to maybe go and visit an aunt and uncle for a while, and they haven't got an aunt and uncle. Is Rosedale Center any use in a situation like that?
Yes, you can do parental placements. It's a sliding scale fee because it costs money to have your child monitored. I would tell you that I wouldn't say Rosedale is the first step to something like that. I am not a fan of separating parents and mm-hmm. children. If there's a way to keep them at home and working together, I would start first with in-home services,
mm-hmm.
which would be through our counseling and therapy departments, to see is there any way we can keep this family together, intact, and working for a future, as opposed to separating one unit out of that family. But if a unit had to be separated out and a child had to be placed, Rosedale would be their mm-hmm. first level of placement outside of the family for a very short amount of time. I think it's 48 hours. And within that 48 hours, staff would be wanting to meet with the family, meet with the youth, and do as much reparative work
right.
as they could to put them back together moving forward.
Mm-hmm.
It's just good damage control. I never want youth to see themselves as disposable.
Right.
So we want to keep units intact and moving forward.
Now, you particularly are involved with a relatively new program of YSS called AMP.
Yes.
Achieving Maximum Potential. Would you like to tell us about that, the history of that?
Yeah, that's my favorite thing in the world to talk about. Anyhow, AMP was born in 2006 under the name of Elevate in Polk County as a brainchild of foster adoptive parents whose children did not have a voice in court, and the parents felt that the children needed a voice in court. So they wrote a grant and received a grant, $6,000, through DCAP funding.
Can I just backtrack a bit? Because mm-hmm. when you say they needed a voice in court, that's a little fuzzy to me. What kind of situation would they be in court, for example?
When you have system youth that are in our mm-hmm. foster care system, the court is their ultimate authority. So the judge and the attorneys, both sides of the fence, the attorney for the youth and the attorney for either the juvenile court or for the Department of Human Services. So they're court officials.
Uh-huh.
The youth is the life they're making decisions about.
Right.
Thank goodness this has changed. But back in the olden days, youth used to go to court and wait out in the hallway to hear what was determined they needed to have happen.
No, they weren't even in the courtroom.
That's
yeah.
correct.
Okay.
So that's very frustrating for those of us who live with those youth, and I was a foster parent at that time, along with many of my other colleagues, and we talked about how frustrating it is for us to take the youth to court, to stand in the hallway, to have no voice, and then we're the ones taking the youth back home when they are either elated by what happened at court or devastated. And we're there to clean up the pieces. That was frustrating. Mm-hmm. So we wrote a grant for a youth advocacy program. That is taking youth voice and allowing it to be heard in all venues.
Mm-hmm.
So in the court system, with the Department of Human Services, with their juvenile court officers, with their families, with the community at large, with service organizations, anybody to say, this is our life, this is what it looks like from our perspective, help guide us. We'll give back while you give to us, and we'll make it a reciprocal relationship. And from that thinking, AMP was born. So AMP became AMP in 2011 when Youth and Shelter Services became the parent agency.
Now, how did that happen, the switchover?
Early in 2011, the Department of Human Services put out a request for proposals, and anybody that was a nonprofit in Iowa could write a request saying, if we had the Elevate program, this is what we would do with it. And George Belitzos at YSS wrote the best grant, or the chosen grant, with his philosophy about how you deal with youth and how you empower youth. And that was the chosen grant when it went through the evaluation process, and the program was then awarded to Youth and Shelter Services in Ames.
From there,
because he's such a good person, he moved the staff up with that program. To me, it was coming home, because Youth and Shelter Services has always been my community, my agency. I always think of this as my home agency. But I had been down at Children and Families of Iowa for this program, because that's how impressive this program is to me. It gave you the voice. So anyhow, when we got back up here, we have grown and grown and grown and grown. We have 13 councils statewide, and we reach about 3,000 youth every year. And each of the councils, on the low side, might have 10 to 12 youth attending, and on the high side can have 40 to 50 attending. Most of the councils meet twice a month for an hour and a half to 2 hours. It's up to the youth. And we have a welcome part of that. Some of the councils have a meal. Some just have snacks that are donated in by the local communities or supported by local service organizations. And then AMP gives back to those service organizations with time and labor and all of that. So there's some beautiful community partnerships. One that the AMP youth did in December was working with the Kiwanis in wrapping gifts at North Grand Mall. And the youth go out and wrap presents to help other people out. And that is just of their heart. They sign up, and we usually have to say, oh, we can only take three or we can only take four, because we have so many youth who have been blessed in their hearts and want to give back to the Ames community.
It sounds like it gives young people an opportunity to get together and to do things and to meet people in similar situations, meet other young people in similar situations and do things together. But ultimately gives them a voice, makes them good advocates for themselves.
That's right. One of the pieces that we really work on is AMP, is taking that journey that they've been on, and they draw it out for me, or they paint it out for me, or they, however they want to tell me their journey and tell their other council members their journey, turning that journey into, look what you've learned.
So when you say their journey, this would probably could be a horror story.
Most of them are.
A horror story. So that horror story, which is something perhaps that they kept quiet about, but this becomes something they can talk about and talk about in a different way.
You bet. It's reframed into, look what you have survived. What have you learned from going through this? And how can you teach that to others? As a way of turning around, I always say you keep one hand reaching for the future. And you have one hand that you reach back for, in case there's another hand back there that needs your help pulling it through.
Ah. This is Local Talk, and I'm talking to Ruth Buckles from Youth and Shelter Services. And she's been talking about a particular part of the programs that Youth and Shelter Services offers called AMP, Achieving Maximum Potential. And I was just going to ask you, Ruth, are there any particular stories or particular youth, perhaps some of the ones that you've been personally involved with, that you'd like to tell our listeners about?
Oh, there are hundreds of stories. And I always promise the youth I won't retell their stories. I can give you broad overviews of youth that have overcome chemical addiction and domestic violence, or, you know, my own daughter who went through human trafficking and came out on the other side of that, stronger and smarter and now giving back.
Well, as you know, I did interview your daughter the other day, and I was just amazed at what she had to say. And she's now got a job in here in Ames and has just had a promotion, but she was humanly trafficked And one of the things that you and I were talking about a little before we began recording was when someone like that is in a desperate situation, a runaway, perhaps from a horrible situation, they just don't know where to turn. I mean, there are all these services there for them, but they're not aware of how to tap into them.
Correct.
And what do you think, what do you think the answer to that is?
AMP is one of the answers.
Right.
Because we are trying to reach every youth, and there are about 6,000, give or take, in the Iowa foster care system. And foster care is not just family foster care. Foster care includes the shelters, the treatment centers, the family homes, as well as, you know, any out-of-home placement. So if you're living with your kin or your relatives, that is a legal classification of foster care in the state of Iowa. So any of those youth, just letting them know what are the resources that are out there. Maybe they need extra help like cooking classes, or how do you change a tire, or how do you manage financial situations like I'm going to be 18 and I need to sign a lease for an apartment, and how do I do that? The life skills that they might be missing. So each part of an AMP meeting starts with the food or the snacks and the greetings of each other. Then there's a skill development piece of it, where we are teaching a lesson that they've asked for.
Mm-hmm.
So they pick and choose whatever they want to learn, and we go out into the community as facilitators and adults and find someone to come and teach that aspect. So we give them two things. We give them the information, but we also give them a contact person. And for the community, that gives that person that recognition of all of those youth. And the youth, when they see an adult come in to their meeting, their council meeting, and share their basket weaving ability or their painting ability or their car tire ability or, you know, whatever their ability is, they see an adult giving back and saying, wow, we really are somebody they care about. Look, they just gave us an hour. Does that make sense?
Yes, it does.
Okay.
Yes.
And then we give back. You know what? These people gave these things to us. How can we help them? And it's like paying it forward. So it's constantly reframing what could be perceived as a rough life or difficult situations and reframing them into, you know what, you came through it. How'd you do it?
Mm-hmm.
How can you pay that forward and help it so the next youth, one, doesn't have to go through it, or two, if they go through it, you're there as the wind beneath their wings.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what all of the AMP councils do. Every facilitator, every support person, every community volunteer, they love the concept of not creating more victims,
right,
but creating people who have unique life experiences that then have a voice all over Iowa.
Now, just suppose someone listening to this program right now is someone in a desperate situation, doesn't know where to turn. What would you tell them to do?
If they are a foster adoptive youth in the state of Iowa, I would want them to email me or call me. Find me at Youth and Shelter Services. Go onto our AMP website. They can access Youth and Shelter Services.
So they should call this number?
They can call
233. That's 515-233-3141.
Right. They can call that one. Most of the youth are computer or they text. So I give them my phone number, which is 515-460-4802, or my email account, because they send it right straight in. And a lot of times it's easier for them to type it to me than it is for them to tell it to me.
Uh-huh.
So I always try and make the written avenues the easiest access for them to get to. So the AMP website, it has a little button that says contact us that comes right straight into my desk, and then I can contact back. I can get resources to them. Or I'll go find them. You know, whatever it is that I can do to help. Most of the time, it's getting them connected to other youth. Because one of the things that AMP, we really believe in, is I as an adult am no person's savior. But the other youth that I can connect them to that have been there, done that, and survived it, they become that positive peer culture around
right.
that youth to build them up and pull them through. So if I have a youth that's really struggling with maybe a sexual identity issue, maybe it's a chemical dependency issue, maybe it's domestic violence, maybe it's a really bad relationship at home with parents, or maybe in the dating relationships that are very, very challenging
mm-hmm.
for youth, I'm going to connect them to other youth who have had and overcome that experience and say, this person needs to talk to you. And they know to build each other up. They know to have each other's back. And they're very good at that because that's very human to all of us.
Could you just tell us, to finish, something about your own life at home and how many children you have at home and so on?
Oh, my husband Bill and I have 12 adopted children, 2 foster kids, and 4 biological children. Add to that about 90 foster adoptive youth that I've had in my home since 1988,
yeah.
And they're often about. The oldest one of them is 8 years younger than I am. So, you know, it's way cool to have...
Yeah, you look very... I mentioned when you first came, you look very young to have teenage children.
And my older children have given me foster grandbabies and have great lives and all of that. So I get to be in contact with all of them, but very busy. I have 9 at home right now. 7 of those are mine, and 2 of them are fostered right now and going to be aging into their own lives as we go through a junior and a senior this year. And I've gotten it down to doing all of those parental things are very systematic in my home.
Mm-hmm.
So you cook on these days, you clean on these days, you take care of these things. And then all of the youth have either jobs or volunteer activities. They're all involved with the AMP councils. I try and keep them as busy as possible because when they see that their world is very, very broad and their options are unlimited, they turn their own lives into something really, really positive. And that's what I've gotten very attached to watching as a foster adopt mom for the last 26 years.
Well, it sounds as if you're doing an absolutely wonderful job and performing a wonderful service for Iowa's youth. And thank you so much for coming to talk to us today. And once again, for Youth and Shelter Services, people should go online, yss.org, or phone 515-233-3141 for Youth and Shelter Services.
Welcome to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, where we explore the people, stories, and events in Central Iowa. I'm your host for today with Ursula Rudenberg, and I'm here with Susan Franson. KHOI reporter Kay Puttock has been talking with Ruth Buckles about the work of YSS.
And what an enthusiastic person she is. It's clear that one of the reasons Youth and Shelter Services, better known in Ames as YSS, is so successful, because it is the passion and dedication of staff and volunteers like Ruth. But there is no question that the vision of George Belitsos, its founder, has been at the heart of it. Earlier this year, I interviewed George in a connection with work I was doing to feature historic preservation of buildings in Ames. Since the Jacobson Building, former Ames City Hall, was saved by actions taken by George and made into the headquarters of Youth and Shelter Services, he was the first person I spoke with. We met in his office looking out on the corner of 5th and Kellogg for a discussion with a lot about the history of Ames.
So let's listen to that interview now.
Really has a very rich and long history. The spot that the municipal building sat on, the building that we're in right now, will be 100 years old in 2015, and we want to really celebrate its 100th anniversary. But at the time it opened at the dedication, the mayor said, and we have a copy of his speech because it was all held in a time capsule that was uncovered as we were doing the remodeling of the municipal building, that he dedicated the building to the mothers and children of Ames because this building was built to last the ages and it would be there for future generations. When the city was here, they had put up several bond issues to build a new city hall, and 2 of them failed. But then, when they picked up the idea of converting the old high school into the new city hall, people of Ames supported it, And I've always known that the community of Ames really has a high places a high value on preserving old buildings. And when they vacated this building, it was empty for 5 years, and it was on the plan of the city to tear it down and put a parking lot here, because parking is such a big problem in downtown Ames. And of course, I have always believed that this building was worth saving, and so did a lot of other people in Ames. When we approached the city, they had in their capital improvements budget $50,000 to tear it down. And I said, let us save you $50,000 and let YSS buy it from you, because we really were in desperate need of new space and expanded space. The city then subsequently, they didn't really want to put it out for bid. And they really wanted to tear it down. And it would have cost $50,000 and more to tear it down, because this building, just as the mayor said 100 years ago, was built to last. The foundation is 20 inches thick. It was in bad shape at the time because it had been vacant for 5 years and the roof leaked, and there was concern about asbestos and all this other unknowns that you might confront in trying to remodel. A group of people got together, and we applied to put it on the National Register of Historic Places. And if that took place, first of all, it had to be declared a local landmark. And our local commission, Historic Preservation Commission, I think it was led by Riad Mahaney at the time, did make it a local landmark, historic landmark. And that then we hired a researcher who did all the research and filled out all the forms, and it was placed on the National Register of Historic Places. The city then could not tear it down. They put it out for bid. The first bid, we were outbid, and it went to a developer who was going to turn the building into restaurants and small shops. He defaulted, never did develop the building. He couldn't get the financing together, so it was put out a second time. YSS put a bid of $500 on the building, and we got it. And we then went about raising $2.5 million, $2 million for the complete remodel and restoring as much of the original floor plan and woodwork and marble as possible. And that came actually within budget. And then it's $500,000 for a special endowment fund to maintain the building for the future.
When was this? What year?
It was 1995. That we bought the building. The remodeling started almost immediately. We had Pike do the work, put a new roof on, tested for asbestos. What little asbestos there was removed. It was really minor. And put in an elevator, made it handicapped accessible. The biggest remodeling was the fire station end of the building. And we actually added on to the back of that building for a stairway. The whole building is 17,500 square feet. And in the end, it cost us $65 a square foot. And that, for this location, it was quite a good deal for YSS.
Well, I couldn't help thinking, just the bottom line price, that you couldn't do that today. Or even 10 years ago. So you really got it at the right time.
We did.
And saved it at the right time. Well, it's obvious that you really care about historic preservation. I understand that YSS has another building on the National Register of Historic Places that also has great historic significance for Ames. So would you like to talk about that a little bit?
I'd love to, because I'm very, very proud that we have two buildings on the National Register of Historic Places, the first being the Municipal Building and the second being the Youth Recovery House. when YSS first built or bought that building, it was a 5-unit apartment building. But it was an old mansion called the Bud Mansion that had been converted long ago to apartments. After we bought it, and we bought the house next door as well, and then we connected the two houses to make what is now Youth Recovery House, we started learning from neighbors and also the documents that you have to go through when you buy a building that, this has a rich history. Professor Bud was the head of the horticulture department at Iowa State, and he had a daughter who was an art teacher at Simpson. And lo and behold, one of her students was George Washington Carver. I think few people realize that he started as a art student. He did not start in horticulture. She recognized that he had a lot going for him and introduced him to horticulture through her dad, and he decided to give up art and come to study horticulture. Lo and behold, we have
back to George Washington Carver, and I'm not quite sure. So he came here as an art student.
He came as he actually came to study horticulture. The first building he came to after he left Simpson, and he originally stayed with the Buds at the Bud Mansion, which is now today Youth Recovery House. Etta Bud never married. She was a teacher her whole life. She took George Washington Carver under her wing. She was a very well-known woman here in Ames. She had the first car, or first woman to drive a car. She had a lot of firsts going for her. And she really cared about Carver and introduced him to her father. Her father then helped him get into Iowa State, and the rest is history. And so that helped put it on the National Register. The front porch of that house had been torn down. We found the plans for the original porch and built that porch as you see it today, and it's exactly how it looked over 100 years ago. The property that the Bud Mansion was built on was also the site of Ames' first school. The foundation of the building, by the way, that school burned down, the foundation of that building was the foundation that most of the house was built on. It's very interesting to look at that foundation, and there's a crawl space back there, and we found a number of old items that we turned in turned into the library. We also have we found a time capsule here at the municipal building, and all of those items were turned into the Ames Public Library. I think they have now found their way to the Historical Society. And we really have enjoyed having that house on the National Register. We've kept it up very well. The kids hear about the history of the house, and I think it helps preserve and maintain the house because the kids have more respect for it than they might otherwise. So there have been many really good spinoffs. After we put it on the National Register, a number of the neighbors gave us more information about the Buds and about George Washington Carver, and we actually put together a booklet that is available here at YSS on the history of the what is now Youth Recovery House, and it's a very interesting read. The history goes back to 1855, and the property was originally owned by Hoyt Sherman. That's a familiar name. And then you can see it over the years. It passed to Cynthia Duff and John Blair, all famous names here in Ames, and many years later to J.L. Bud, Professor Bud, and that's the house that stands there now.
What really strikes me and what you're telling me is the accidental significance that the building was originally dedicated to mothers and children. Mm-hmm. And here it is, serving mothers and children. It is, you almost feel the building has a personality. that it's an extension of human beings, but it's an extension that's more than just bricks and mortar.
I like to think of both of these buildings, the Youth Recovery House, if the George Washington Carver and Professor Budd knew how the building was being used today for disadvantaged kids who are chemically dependent, who are struggling to overcome addiction and to overcome all kinds of hardships that they have gone through in their young lives, to think, hey, there was George Washington Carver overcoming discrimination, overcoming as the first African American to attend Iowa State with support from the people in that house. The same tradition is being carried on today. The City Hall, the old municipal building, I would like to think that if the city founders who, I mean, the population of Ames at that time was just over 5,000, and they built a 17,000 square foot City Hall, and they built it to last, dedicated it, as you said, to the mothers and children of the future. And the building is serving the mothers and the children to this very day. When I first came to Ames, my introduction to the City Hall was through the police department, because I used to come down here to actually the what we call the first floor of the building. It's three stories, but the first floor was the jail and the police department, and they had a juvenile jail, and I would come down with the judge's permission, and I would basically rescue kids from the jail and take them to what was then Iowa's first emergency youth shelter. I would often go to court upstairs on the third floor, and I would go talk to the judge and let him know that we had beds available and we'd rescue these kids out of that jail. And we now, all these years later, have served 7,500 kids at our, what was Iowa's first emergency youth shelter. And it all got started right here in Ames as the first shelter in the state for troubled kids. And when I think back to all those years ago when I used to come to City Hall and get these kids out of jail and take them to the shelter, to think that one day in the future this would be the YSS headquarters is just the most remarkable story. And no one could have ever guessed that YSS would, that this very same building that was the jail and the fire department and the center of city government would be the headquarters of a youth service agency.
For those of you who don't, for those who don't know you, it might be helpful to find out a little bit about why you were getting kids out of jail and what motivated you to start a youth recovery house.
Well, the whole youth and shelter services was started as a volunteer effort. I came to Ames in the time of the very end of the Vietnam War in the early 70s, and I was a conscientious objector, and I was here to do 2 years of alternative service. And my assignment was to assist troubled kids in the community. There were very few resources. I was working with the campus YMCA, and that was my assignment for 2 years. And that's what got Iowa's first emergency youth shelter started.
I remember those years, and I know there were a lot of runaways at that time. You don't hear so much about runaways now. Maybe they still have them, but they were very common. I knew, personally knew, families in Ames whose sons and daughters just disappeared. We didn't think they'd been kidnapped. They just left.
Back in the early 70s, the counterculture had really caught up to Ames, and there were a lot of anti-war demonstrations. There were a lot of the kids were hanging out in Welch Street. In fact, that's one of our goals, was to get the kids off of Welch Street because they were getting in trouble there, being arrested for any number of things like breaking in or just loitering. We had real tension in the city at that time, and there were a lot of runaways. Ames was a mecca for runaways. Just to bring you up to date, today we're still seeing a lot of runaways. Iowa recorded through law enforcement, over 4,000 runaways last year. But I think there were about double that in the early 70s. And a lot of them were kids that had not committed any crimes. They were just having family problems. A lot of them, the further away they'd get from home, the more in trouble they and more exploitation would take place. When we opened what is now Rosedale Shelter, back then was called Shelter House, it was unique. There were no other emergency youth shelters. And after we got started and several things happened to get us on the front page of the paper, the Des Moines Register, other people picked up the idea, and that program, our program here in Ames, was used as a model for the rest of the state.
Do you have any concluding remarks you'd like to make?
I would like to say that Ames and the community of Ames really have great respect for the history. And the more of our history that you know, the greater the respect will grow. These two houses or two buildings that we talked about, it would have been such a loss for the walls to come down. And old buildings can be put to very good reuse, not only for nonprofits such as YSS, but it could be a bank, it could be any kind of business at all. And I just hope that our community continues to believe that our history needs to be preserved, and a big part of that are the buildings.
You're listening to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, and we were just listening to an interview of Susan speaking with Mr. George Palitzos, the Director of Youth and Shelter Services, with a really powerful interview, Susan, that not only speaks about young people, but also the buildings in this town and the history of this town, the work that some people have done to build meaning in this community. We're featuring Youth and Shelter Services this month as the Community Service Appreciation Program to feature one nonprofit a month that performs an important community service.
The remaining part of our program this morning will be turned over to reporter Pat Schlarbaum, who has gathered some information for us about a play happening in Des Moines this weekend.
We're here today with key members of the production. My name is Rachel Corey. Producer Maria Filippone, director David A. Van Cleve, and actress Emily Stabney. The play is about a young woman that took her aspirations of world peace to the Middle East in 2003. And Rachel was killed defending a Palestinian family's home from bulldozer destruction. There are three performances: Friday, January 11th at 7:30, Saturday at 7:30 p.m., and Sunday, a matinee at 2 p.m. First, producer Maria Filippone.
Why is it that you think this is a good program for Iowa at this time?
It's timeless. It's good at any time, anywhere in the entire world. It's an issue that's very important.
Let's delve into Rachel's story, her life. Mm-hmm. Could you give us a little snapshot, if you will?
She grew up in Olympia, Washington, with two siblings and her parents, and it sounds like her parents were pretty awesome parents. Kind of laid back where they needed to be laid back, let her kind of figure things out. And she was an excellent, excellent writer and kept journals and diaries and just wrote a lot.
High school and college?
Her whole life. All through her whole life. And she went to Evergreen College in her hometown, and she became involved being an activist for different causes and became involved with a group in Olympia, which dealt directly with trying to have peace in the Middle East. Also tried to work for human rights for the Palestinians specifically. Ended up going over to Palestine, and she was killed March 16, 2003, by an Israeli bulldozer as she was trying to protect the house of a family in Rafah.
How long had she been in Palestine?
Not even 2 months.
Not even 2 months before
she arrived January 24th and then was killed March 16th.
Is the play developed on her writings then?
The entire play is all in her words. From throughout her life, you get a beautiful picture of what a beautiful person she was.
It's a challenging script because, like you were saying, it's so heavy. It's such a heavy issue. And lots of politics in dealing with a beautiful person who has passed away. telling her story with her own words is so powerful and so heavy at the same time. But then we have little moments, like the hysterically moment, that is just, if the audience doesn't laugh, I feel bad for them. Because it's about 80 minutes of one woman talking. And you're used to seeing theater where there's a lot of action going on. And with one woman talking, sometimes there's not any action. But Alan Rickman has done such a nice job of stringing along these moments and putting the funny moments right in the middle of the serious moments.
Oh, the people that wrote the
book. Who edited the writing. Yeah. And they've kind of rearranged things by theme, and they've done a beautiful job with the structure of it.
Mm-hmm.
But going through and reading her writings and seeing the dates on it, yeah. There have been several moments when Emily and I have just been like, what do we do?
Yeah.
But to be working with an actress like Emily, we've worked together before. There was a moment the other night when I was giving her a note, and I couldn't figure out the words to say. And I just started making faces, and I said, the part, and she's like, okay. And
I knew exactly what you were trying to say.
I didn't know for sure she knew what I was saying, and then the next time we ran through it, she did exactly what I wanted her to do, even though I never said a word. So it's been a roller coaster, but I wouldn't have wanted to go through on this roller coaster with anyone but these two wonderful ladies, so it's been fun. There's been laughter.
There have been laughter, there have been tears, and there have been there have just been lots and lots of...
There have been cookies.
Right, there have been cookies and dark chocolate pomegranate seeds and just lots and lots of, life happening around this script. And I think that that's really important. And the more that I think about it, this script has just become such a part of my life. Now, whenever I sit down to make a to-do list, I think of Rachel. Whenever I see lights in windows and houses, I think of Rachel. And it's just all of these little things. And if we can just get one person to make a to-do list and think of Rachel, then that's the goal. Just have it become an ingrained part of your life like this.
Like Maria said earlier, it is timeless. It is always relevant. It is a story of peace and what we can do to get off our behinds and do something.
And now Rachel Corey's parents, Cynthia and Craig Corey from Olympia, Washington.
Craig and I have very deep Iowa connections. We both grew up in Iowa. I'm originally from Western Iowa, from Denison. We both have family members across Iowa. My brother in Denison still is farming the family farm that I grew up on. We make journeys there regularly. I always say I need some time to have my Iowa fix every year. So we're particularly happy that we're going to make it back again very soon. Craig grew up in Des Moines. We met at Drake University.
I've got my Drake. I'm sitting here with my Drake sweatshirt on, and thinking back, it's appalling to me, but 50 years ago, I was the senior at Roseville High School on the west side of Des Moines, so we have strong Iowa connections, and like Cindy says, we're really happy to be able to come back for the play. My name is Rachel Corey.
And there's a Roosevelt High School connection. The young woman who is portraying your daughter is a senior at Roosevelt High School, Emily Stabnik.
We're so looking forward to meeting her and to seeing her performance. I think through this past almost 11 years since Rachel was killed, the play My Name is Rachel Corey has been seen all over the world. And Craig and I have been blessed to have opportunities to meet many different actresses. And I'm always so moved by how much they integrate Rachel's story. It's a very demanding role, a lot of words to say. And it's just inspiring to me to see the very unique productions. One of the things we've learned about theater is just how creative a medium it is. And even though it's the same words that we see and hear in different productions, each young woman brings herself so much to that experience.
Oh, it's so powerful. The words are your daughter's taken from her diaries, I understand?
Yeah, that's correct. They're taken from diaries, from emails, and sometimes from things that she wrote in class. They're her words. They were edited by the British actor Alan Rickman, who Rachel's emails from Gaza, they were first published in the Guardian newspaper, and a friend of Alan Rickman's read it there and then handed the paper to Alan and said, you should read this. He took it to the Royal Court Theater, and he and Catherine Viner, editor for the Guardian, put together from from Rachel's writings, this play. And so it's all Rachel's words, or occasionally there's something that is an email from Cindy or me or another friend of Rachel's, but they're all written by the people that it's attributed to. It's pretty astonishing the way they put it together and moving. And I would say, I want to put this out there because I don't think any of the listeners would dream of it, but the play is also funny. At the beginning, it's very powerful at the end, but it's also funny, and I don't think that that's something that people would expect when they go to the theater.
Things that for us is so important and magical about the play is that we want Rachel to be remembered for the creative, interesting person that she was, not only for how she died in Gaza. We're so grateful that she's remembered still, and we have the privilege to talk about her with people. And we're grateful for the knowledge that she brought to us about what was happening in the Middle East. She was a person with broad interest and broad insight as a young person, and I hope that people will appreciate a chance to come to know her better.
I'm certainly looking forward to adding to the collective strength that Rachel has initiated. Hopefully bring some awareness to a part of the world that needs some assistance.
Thanks so much.
Thank you very much. And I hope that your listeners, those that can, will show up at one of the three performances this weekend, because I think that the people that see it will be moved by it and enjoy parts of it, like I say, laugh at parts of it, but also be moved by it. And we'd love to see people there.
It's all taking place here at Des Moines on Stage, 2124 Grand, Des Moines, Iowa, right next to the Red Cross, this Friday night, Saturday night, this coming weekend, January 10th and 11th at 7:30, and then 2 o'clock matinee Sunday the 12th. Any and all donations will go directly to the Rachel Corey Foundation, and they work for peace in the Middle East and to specifically aid Palestinians. We hope that the performances here in Central Iowa just get people to think critically about the images they see and what they hear on mainstream media about this issue, and question things, and hopefully get some people to start taking some action.
In a positive way.
Mm-hmm.
Listening to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio. Your hosts have been Susan Franzen and Ursula Rudenberg. Today, we have heard from George Belitzos, Director of Youth and Shelter Services, and Ruth Buckles of Youth and Shelter Services. Those heard in the final segment were Marie Philippone, David A. Cleave, Emily Stavnik, Cynthia and Craig Corey. KHOI reporters were Kay Puttock and Pat Schlarbaum.
Local Talk is engineered by Richard Morrison and Becca Brown, and our theme song is Backtracking by Al Harris and Tom Richards from their CD, Ballad of Kate Shelley. Local Talk is a radio production workshop as well as a radio show, and if you would like to join the team as a reporter, contact us at 292-2878. That's 292-2878. Or come and see us at the Ames Pantorium at 410 Douglas in Ames. If you enjoyed this show, tell your friends. And if you really enjoyed it, please consider contributing to KHOI.
Your participation as audience is what makes KHOI possible. Thank you for listening, and see you again on the radio.